If I thought I could help you, Dumbledore said gently, by putting you into an enchanted sleep and allowing you to postpone the moment when you would have to think about what has happened tonight, I would do it. But I know better. Numbing the pain for a while will make it worse for you when you finally feel it. You've shown bravery beyond anything I could have expected of you. I ask you to demonstrate your courage one more time. I ask you to tell us what happened. Welcome to the Basic Cinephile Podcast, Season 1, Harry Potter. Hello everyone, I'm your host, Sienna.
And I'm your other host, Adelia. This season on the Basic Cinephile Podcast, we are reading all the Harry Potter books and watching all the Harry Potter movies. And this week, we are kicking off episode 7 with the fourth book, The Goblet of Fire.
This podcast contains spoilers. This book has been out for 22 years, so we don't feel bad spoiling anything and everything about it. But if you want to read it first, pause the episode and go read all of the books and binge all of the movies. Because honestly, who knows how many books and movies we will end up referencing in this episode.
In Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Harry is whisked away from the Dursleys before the end of the summer so that he can attend the Quidditch World Cup with Ron and the Weasleys. It's his first time attending a professional Quidditch match, his first time traveling by portkey, and his first time being surrounded by wizards outside of Hogwarts and Diagon Alley.
Harry is blown away by the spectacle of it all, especially by the formidable Bulgarian seeker, Victor Krum. Everyone is in good spirits after Ireland's victory, but things get weird when a group of Death Eaters parade through the celebration with bewitched muggles. The Dark Mark is set off, and Barty Crouch dismisses his house elf, Winky, after she is caught with Harry's wand, the wand that set off the Dark Mark.
Things only get stranger after Harry returns to Hogwarts, and Dumbledore announces that the Quidditch season has been cancelled because Hogwarts will be hosting the Triwizard Tournament. Durmstrang and Beauxbatons schools have brought some of their students, and each school will submit names into the Goblet of Fire to determine who their champion will be. Each school is allowed one champion, and the champion must be at least 17 years old because the challenges will be dangerous and require a high level of expertise. But everyone is shocked when Harry Potter is chosen by the Goblet of Fire to be the fourth tournament champion. Who tricked the goblet and submitted his name? Because it wasn't Harry.
Sirius Black and the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, Professor Moody, are both convinced that someone has it out for Harry. But Ron and the rest of the students seem to think that it's just Harry showing off and wanting the glory. Harry manages to get past the first challenge, an ornery dragon, and the second challenge, an underwater rescue of the champion's closest friends from the merpeople in the lake outside Hogwarts.
Harry's tied with Hogwarts' other champion, Cedric Diggory, as they head into the third and final challenge, a maze filled with dangerous creatures. Harry and Cedric reach the end of the maze at the same time, and both decide to share the victory and grab the Triwizard Cup at the same moment. But the cup has been turned into a portkey that delivered Harry and Cedric straight to Lord Voldemort. Wormtail kills Cedric and brews a potion to give Voldemort a new body. Once returned to human form, Voldemort sets out to do what he's been waiting 13 years to do, kill Harry.
The two duel, but because their wands both share a twin core, a feather from Fox the Phoenix, Harry is able to escape with his life and Cedric's body. Back at Hogwarts, Harry learns that Professor Moody is actually the Death Eater Barty Crouch Jr. He brewed Polyjuice Potion and has been impersonating the famous Auror all year to ensure that Harry would be delivered to Lord Voldemort. Even though Harry escaped, Crouch's plan worked, and Lord Voldemort is officially back. The Ministry of Magic might not be taking Harry seriously when he tells them that Voldemort has returned to power, but Dumbledore and the rest of the Hogwarts staff who fought Voldemort the last time spring into action. Voldemort is back, and this time they are going to be ready for him.
Okay, so what did you think of this book?
I love this book. I mean, this is like, I know I say this every week. I'm like, this is the book that really got me into it. But like, honestly, this was the book that really solidified how much I loved Harry Potter.
I mean, it is incredibly long. And I remember just binge reading this, like staying up all night and possibly not sleeping. Like I was very young, but still this book held me the entire time.
This is the first book I ever read like overnight, because I remember this. I was reading it. I was literally like under the covers with a flashlight, like you see in the movies, kids hiding. I was not supposed to be awake, but I wasn't tired, so I was reading. And I was like, okay, I'm just gonna read one more chapter because it's getting late. Then I'm gonna go to sleep. And in that one chapter, the Triwizard Cup turned into a portkey, and Cedric Diggory is murdered, and Voldemort is getting a body. So I was in fifth grade, and I was kind of terrified. Like, this part got pretty scary, and I was like, I can't sleep with that in my head. So I stayed up and finished the rest of the book. I think I was up till like 3 or 4 in the morning.
I don't blame you. I mean, it's so amazing, and it honestly has my favorite first chapter of all the series. So you get the housekeeper for Tom Riddle's family's house,
yeah,
going up to their old house that has become decrepit, and you know, he's just trying to upkeep all this stuff, and he goes in and he sees Wormtail and Voldemort in this like very weird form, and Nagini, and then you all of a sudden realize that it's Harry being able to see this moment happening.
Yeah.
You know, it's really the first time that you get this like very deep connection beyond just like Voldemort is nearby, or, you know, he's really angry, any of that. You're like, he is there. He shares a soul.
Yeah. It's that really like clear vision and clear look into what Voldemort is seeing, but Harry not really understanding that he's actually witnessing something that is really happening. And we've talked about this before, how the first chapter of Harry Potter books are always the worst, because it's just this like bland recap of what happened in the previous book, and then we get to jump into the action. And this book starts off different. Yeah, it starts off with like a mystery for everyone. You're introducing this house like groundskeeper character that no one has ever known. So you're like, wait, what is happening? Where are we? Who is this? And so this whole book really starts off with a bang, and I love it.
Yeah, it's amazing. But then the second chapter, it like goes back to the same formula of like, Harry Potter was not a normal boy. He was a wizard.
Again, I have a feeling her publishers were probably like, put in a little summary.
Yeah.
And that's what she did.
Previously on Harry Potter.
Previously, in the last 800 books or 800 pages of this book, let me explain what happened.
Yeah.
But also, so then, you know, it always starts off at the Dursleys, but he's barely at the Dursleys in this one, which is kind of nice, because before the summer is over, the Weasleys come and take Harry to the Quidditch World Cup. So I do still feel like even the recap annoying part of the book is shorter than in a lot of the other ones.
It's definitely shorter, and you get the introduction to Weasley Wizard Wheezes. You know, mm-hmm. They try and use the flu network to this closed off fireplace, because, I mean, how many muggles have turned their wood burning fireplaces into an electric fireplace?
That's exactly what I would do if that was my house.
Oh, absolutely. So I think it's so funny that they show up and they're like, we're in your wall and we're just kind of like screaming and trying to get out.
Yeah, they're like trapped, and like people keep showing up and they're all stuck behind the fireplace. And then, yeah, that whole fiasco with the Dursleys. But then Harry is like, that part's pretty short. And then he's like back into the wizarding world.
Yeah.
So we get the burrow right out of the gate. And then we also get the introduction of some new characters. Like, we know that Ron has older brothers, but Charlie and Bill, like, haven't really gotten a whole lot of airtime. But obviously, it's like, Dad got the hookup with tickets to the Quidditch World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll get some time off work.
Yeah, seriously, I'll call in some PTO. I'm going to be there, because yeah, we're going to get some, like, really good seats.
Yes, so you get the whole Weasley dynamic, like all of them together, all of them under one roof. And then you also get like the additional bonus kids that they have, because at this point Hermione is, she's super close to Ron obviously, but she's also really close to Ginny, and then Harry is like their surrogate son. So mm-hmm. We get all of them right out of the gate, and we go straight to the Quidditch World Cup,
and it's just like so much fun. Well, back it up. Their hike to the portkey is just like insane. So when they show up to the portkey, they find that the Diggorys are already there. So we've got Cedric and his dad. waiting on the Weasleys to show up so then they can go to the Quidditch World Cup. And the Weasleys have walked a really long way. And then you find out that the Diggorys got up at 2 a.m. to hike their butts all the way to this Portkey, and it took them 3 hours. So they got up at 2 a.m. for this. And I'm just wondering, like, couldn't there be a way that they put it in a more centralized location?
Again, Wizarding World making no sense. But they get to the Portkey, at least. I mean, yeah, you're out in literally the middle of nowhere, and I'm like, there must have been somewhere a little closer to be able to do this.
Maybe take a taxi, do some muggle travel, get closer.
For real, if you got up at 2 a.m., like, wherever this is happening, like, they probably could have just driven there.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
But we get the introduction of the Portkey, so then later in the book, like, we know what a Portkey is. Mm-hmm. So that's a fun little introduction. And they get to the Quidditch World Cup, and they've got all those fun, like, we get a lot of really fun characters. Like, you've got all these weird wizards walking around. You get Ludo Bagman dressed in, what is he wearing? It's like a raincoat and
I don't remember what
galoshes
he was
or something. He's wearing his old Quidditch uniform. It doesn't fit him anymore because he's got a dad bod going on now. But we've got some other wizards who, there's like the guy who wore like a nightgown.
Yeah, and when they show up and it's the person that's like collecting all the portkeys, he is wearing galoshes and a poncho. No, a kilt. A kilt, yes. And a poncho. And I mean, that's a look. That's a vibe.
The Quidditch World Cup is a runway. Mm-hmm. Life fashion for these wizards trying to look like muggles.
They're muggle clothes. I bought them from muggle places, yeah. So obviously they all go together.
But it's a really fun way to, like, introduce all of these characters that are going to come back and end up being super important. So we get to meet Barty Crouch, and Winky is up in the box at the World Cup.
You get the Vilas, mm-hmm, that are out there dancing, and
Victor Crumb out there playing Quidditch, and you have no idea that he's going to end up being a super important character,
yeah,
in this book. And then, you know, the Malfoys being the Malfoys, we already know them, but we get a little bit of more of an introduction of, like, okay, then we get the Dark Mark get set off, and we've got the Death Eaters just, like, strolling through the celebration to put fear in people, and you get this idea of, like, okay, we know that Lucius Malfoy is part of that.
Yeah.
For sure.
There's really no question at this point for all of us that are reading along.
He's a bad dude.
He's not a good guy. And earlier he makes like a comment towards Hermione that's like super rude and derogatory, and I just love that Hermione does not break eye contact. She just like looks at him, stares at him like, all right, I'm gonna have this old man that is powerful say really terrible things about me, and I'm not gonna let you off the hook with this. I'm mm-hmm. gonna keep eye contact, and you're gonna feel awkward. Because yeah. I'm not going to.
I love her. She's so tough.
She's so tough. And I love that. And speaking of not tough, so they're out there, like, making muggles float around and all these, like, crazy things. And then as soon as the Dark Mark gets put up in the air, they disappear.
They split. When it gets real, they're all out. They're like, oh, crap. I have pretended to not support the Dark Lord for the last 13 years. And I know he's not going to be very happy with me.
Yeah, they're just all very performative and mm-hmm. only utilize it when it's beneficial to them.
Yeah, which then makes you question, like, who did set off the Dark Mark? Because, yeah, all of the Death Eaters split. And then we see Winky, the house elf, and she's freaking out because she's a house elf and she's sworn to secrecy. And no one thinks that she's the one who wanted to set off the Dark Mark, you know? That doesn't make any sense. And it's not until the end of the book that we realize that, you know, it really wasn't her. But with Winky being so important in those early chapters, that's when Hermione gets to learn more about house elves and how they're straight up slaves.
Yeah.
And it's messed up. She's the only one who seems to think, like, hey, we should be paying people for their labor. We should... And everyone's just like, oh, well, it's fine. You know,
they like it.
They like it. And Hermione's like, okay, well, have we tried giving them options? Have we tried teaching them, you know, new ways to find fulfillment and satisfaction? Yeah, this might be the only way that they are happy now, but they've also kind of been brainwashed to think that this is their whole life's purpose.
Yeah, and like, even though you enjoy doing something doesn't mean that you need to like volunteer all of your time and giftings to make it better for other people. Like, why can't we compensate them? Why can't we give them a few days off? Or, like, show them how to have fun, because they don't know.
Yeah. And then it becomes important, too, when we get back to Hogwarts, because Dobby's back.
Yay!
Dobby is back, and he's working at the kitchens in Hogwarts, because Dobby's like, yeah, I'm not going to work for free. I want money. So he goes there to get paid, and then he ends up kind of befriending Winky. Like, Winky's not interested, but Dobby takes Winky under his wing, kind of, and is like, okay, you know, we're both gonna work at Hogwarts, and I'm gonna kind of try and look out for you, because the two of them are a little more ostracized since mm-hmm. they're both free. It's just that Dobby is like all about his freedom, and Winky is like traumatized. Mortified. Yeah, so embarrassed. And then Hermione starts spew.
S-P-E-W. Thank you very much.
What does it stand for again? Oh my God. I don't remember. But it's for the ethical treatment of house elves. And she's trying to get people to join, and like, no one wants to join. And just Hermione continues to be the best out here championing for rights.
Yeah. And it just shows you like the only like muggle of the friends, like pure muggle, is the one that's like championing for equal treatment of all the creatures in the magical world.
Yeah.
Like, she starts with the elves, but then she sees other stuff and she's like, I don't really like how this is going. And I think that it's that fresh perspective that is able to give her such a insightful and powerful.
Yeah.
You know,
well, you don't always notice that something is messed up when it's become normalized for you. Yeah, and you've just been raised around it. And Hermione, like, as an older teenager or older kid, I guess she's a young teen, older kid, is introduced to this and is like, whoa, this is slavery and that's illegal.
Yeah.
And it should be illegal here too.
It's super messed up, and it's a very important part of the journey that they end up going on, because the house elves end up being very, very central to mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah,
all of it.
They do a lot more than just iron your clothes and bake your food. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're great. We also get some other new characters at the beginning of the book. I would say most importantly being Mad-Eye Moody, because of course you get a new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher mm-hmm. every year. Mad-Eye Moody shows up. He's got that creepy eye that's whizzing around. He's like this old school auror that has like seen some stuff mm-hmm. go down. And okay, his first lesson that he gives, he walks in and he's like, yeah, we're going to do unforgivable curses. You're like, what the heck? And
it's super messed up. But then also it kind of tracks with what we've heard so far about Moody, because mm-hmm. like, you've established back at the Burrow that Moody is kind of an unreliable source at this point, because he believes that everyone is out to get him and that mm-hmm. he's like done all this crazy stuff. So you're put off by the fact that he's using these unforgivable curses. But then also it tracks that, like, I want you to see everything that could happen, because it does happen. I've seen it.
Yeah, you totally buy that Mad-Eye Moody, the auror, would come in and just be like, okay, I'm going to scare you straight out the gate. This is what can happen. This is why we're constant vigilance, Potter, you mm-hmm. know? And then when you find out later that he's actually Barty Crouch Jr., you're like, holy crap. It takes on this whole new sadistic turn where you're like, so this guy is a Death Eater who's actively trying to deliver Harry Potter to Lord Voldemort for his death so Voldemort can get his body and come back. And so he sees that he has Harry Potter and Neville Longbottom, both mm-hmm. in his class, he knows that the Dark Lord killed Harry's parents, and he knows that he personally was a part of torturing Neville's parents into insanity. And what does he do? He intentionally inflicts psychological trauma on both of them by showing them both of those curses. What a messed up dude.
It's so creepy rereading it now and seeing just how, yeah, psychological Barty Crouch is on inflicting pain to everyone around him. And yeah. the overlap of Barty Crouch's, his messed up and vindictive personality, and also with Mad-Eye Moody's paranoia, they cross over a lot. So you feel like that could still be Mad-Eye performing these things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just, it really breaks your heart, especially for Neville. You don't find out that his parents were tortured into madness, and that's why he lives with his grandparents or his grandma until the very end of, towards the end of the book. And Neville just like breaks down. You see him just completely go into this place of trauma, and it, you realize that Harry isn't the only one who's experienced this loss. In fact, a lot of these kids in this classroom have had family members that were impacted by the Death Eaters and Voldemort when they were in power. And Neville really got the short end of the stick on this. And he doesn't get any of the credit that Harry does, this like notoriety, this fame. Not that Harry wanted it, but he really just like lives in this shadow of trauma his whole life.
Yeah. It's our first introduction to Neville's backstory, which is so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
All right. So we are going to take a break to hear from our sponsors for this episode.
Hello there, my fellow basic cinephile fan. Jeremy Hirschkorn of Jet Movement Academy here. In my experience as a gym owner and trainer, I've seen the world start to change. You'll need new strategies to keep your health in top condition. That's why I'm offering Jet Online. This is a complete training and coaching package available wherever you have internet access. Go to jetmovement.com to sign up today or contact me at jeremy@jetmovement.com. Wishing you happy listening and amazing health. Keep moving.
So in this book, there's no Quidditch. Like, we get the Quidditch World Cup, but there's no school Quidditch because of the Triwizard Tournament. So right out of the gate, we get Victor Crumb coming back.
Yeah.
For representing Durmstrang.
Love that he's a student.
Yes. Everyone's like, what the heck? This dude is super famous. And, oh, what the heck? He's actually still a kid. And then we mm-hmm. get Beauxbatons and Madame Maxime and their school champion, Fleur Delacour.
Who is part Vila.
Part Vila. So you get like the celeb factor of Victor Crumb and all the girls like being like, ooh, Victor. And then all the boys being like, oh my God, he's so good at Quidditch. I love him. And then you get Fleur, who's part Vila. So again, you get everyone who's attracted to her.
She's very charming.
Yes, following her around. And then it's like, who is the Hogwarts champion going to be?
And I mean, you get a Hufflepuff, finally. And it's Cedric Diggory, who's just like a great seeker. I mean, he beat Harry in Quidditch. And you know that he's handsome. He's super nice. You've met him at the Quidditch World Cup.
He's the worst kind of person because he's one of those where you're like, okay, you're good looking, you're smart, you're talented. I want to hate you. I want to be jealous of you, but like,
dang, you're so nice. Dang
it, you're nice to me.
Like,
you're excited when his name comes out. You're like, okay, cool. Yeah. Hufflepuff doesn't get a lot of glory and this is their chance to shine. And then the fourth name comes out of the Goblet of Fire.
Yeah, and that's a wild card. And you got Harry, who is young, who has somehow, like, gone past this age line and, you know,
everyone thinks he rigged it to get himself in. And Harry, for the first time in his life, is like, I would love to just, like, take this year off, like, not have any drama.
Yeah, every year has been something, and I just, like, don't want that.
I would love for someone to not try and kill me this year. Yeah. And then his name comes out of the Goblet of Fire and it's like, well, you have to compete in a competition that we have deemed so dangerous that we don't want anyone your age or even close to your age to compete. But you have to.
But yeah,
Again, I know that there's like some magical thing that it's like when your name comes out, you have to compete. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like maybe there's a workaround there and you just say, Harry is a fourth year and he just can't compete. That's a no-go.
It really seems like they should have been able to get him out of that one, but they don't.
They play it as it lies.
They play it as it lies.
And Ron is so frustrated by that. And yeah, he's kind of a turd throughout it, but I also kind of understand. He's always shown up by Harry. He's not the smartest like Hermione, and he is the younger middle kid that just is, he's never extraordinary at anything.
Yeah. And he's really, he feels personally offended because he's like, dude, you clearly figured out how to trick this thing and get your name in. Why didn't you help me so I could put my name in?
I really wanted this.
That's what he's really upset about. Because, I mean, they always talk about the Dursleys, like, or not the Dursleys, the Weasleys being broke. Like, that's a constant theme. And in this one, it really comes up even more. Just like, he wants some money and he would have loved the chance to compete to get some, and he can't. So that kind of goes throughout this whole book of like Ron and Harry are really on the outs with each other for a good portion of the book. Mm-hmm. And then poor Hermione is stuck being the go-between. Like, she's cool with both of them, but she can never hang out with her two best friends at the same time, which would suck.
Yeah. And then she's also got this like blossoming romance with Victor Crumb, and she's crusading for SPEW, and she is still crushing her classes. Like, Hermione, yet again, the GOAT.
Yeah, and on top of all of that, she's trying to keep Harry alive.
Yeah.
And in a way that, like, even if this makes sense, she's trying to keep Harry alive more than Harry is trying to keep Harry alive, because A, she's trying to help him crack these clues and figure out how to get past the challenges, because she understands that these challenges are very dangerous. But she also has like a wider scope of understanding than the boys do. Harry's just like, oh my god, I have to fight a dragon. And she's like, yeah, but who put you in this thing? Like, this is so much bigger than just the Triwizard Tournament. And Hermione sees that. So she's always the one trying to figure out like the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And so she's stressed about trying to get him through these challenges, but then also being like, this is weird. Who did this?
Yeah, and like, why are you getting through these so reasonably easy? Because like, the whole thought process is that somebody's trying to kill him in the tournament.
Yeah.
You know, that you're not supposed to make it through these challenges because they're super dangerous, but somehow he does. And so you feel like some kind of safety and security in that. And then boom, you've got the portkey and everything changes.
So it is kind of fun. Hermione's definitely not the only one who's trying to help Harry through these challenges. We have my personal favorite, Ludo Bagman, throughout is like pulling Harry aside and trying to give him like these little tips and stuff. And Harry the whole time is like, I don't really understand why he's trying to help me. And the reasoning that Ludo gives is like, hey, you're a kid. Like, you're a child. You didn't sign up for this. And I'm looking out for you. So it's like, yeah, I'm kind of trying to give you an unfair advantage of trying to give you some tips and tricks. But also, what is Harry in this book? Like 13, 14 years old?
Yeah.
And he's competing against Victor Crumb, who has a world-class
career
outside of Hogwarts. Clearly, this guy's got some skills. And like, Fleur and Cedric have years of experience on Harry. So it's kind of like this, hey, yeah, I'm trying to give you some tips, but like only because I don't think you have a chance.
But and then also, Dumbledore is like the only one of the headmasters that's like, I'm going to be just hands off. You figure it out on your own. But like Karkaroff and Madame Maxime, they're both like heavily involved in helping their champion learn
if you ain't
what
cheating,
to do.
You ain't trying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But I love that at the end you find out Ludo Bagman was not trying to help Harry for altruistic reasons. He is in some deep gambling debt with the goblins.
Yeah, that's not a debt you want.
And so he's betting on Harry, the underdog, because, you know, the odds on the underdog, if you're going to win and pull off the upset, you can get a lot of money out of it. So he's really trying to cheat and help Harry win just so that he can get out of debt. What a great character.
So much fun. I love Ludo, and I love that you get a moment in the Pensieve where Ludo's being questioned about having given, like, some information to a Death Eater, and they're like, are you part of the Death Eaters? Do you support Voldemort? And he's like, no, I just was talking to somebody, yeah. And they were asking me questions that I just answered, and maybe I'll work at the Ministry of Magic someday. I don't know. Let's see what happens. And you just immediately realize that, like, this is a man who is not trying to cause Harry harm for that reason. He is just somebody who runs his mouth.
He's an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who happened to be really good at Quidditch.
Mm-hmm.
So because he was good at Quidditch, and because, I mean, he's dumb, but he's a likable guy.
Yeah.
So he's funny. He's a people person. He likes to, yeah, chat it up with people. And you can tell he probably enjoys being someone who knows information. And so kind of probably talks it up to make himself look a little more important. And yeah, you find out, like, this guy's not a Death Eater. I don't think he could smuggle secrets out of the Ministry of Magic if he tried.
Yeah.
He was just talking.
Yeah. And I mean, so he was trying to help Harry. And then we have the other people that actually did help Harry. So, you know, Harry helps Cedric by telling him about the dragons in the first challenge. And then Cedric is like, and Harry's a good guy for going to Cedric and be like, let's have an even playing field. Yeah. Everybody else is going to know. And then Cedric comes and tells him what to do with the egg to figure out what the second challenge is, because Cedric is also a good guy. He is also a Hufflepuff, and though he's super competitive, he doesn't like to have some kind of debt. And
we already saw that in the last book, where it's like he caught the snitch or whatever, and he thought it wasn't fair, and he wanted to, like, continue the match. Mm-hmm. So that absolutely tracks for his character in this book to be like, yeah, I want everything to be fair and even. I want to win. Mm-hmm. I still want to crush you, but I don't want to do it because of some disadvantage that someone else had.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he put his name in the Goblet of Fire for a reason. He is competitive, and yeah. He is very good. He's chosen
Homeboy
for a reason.
Homeboy wants to win. Homeboy wants some glory for Hufflepuff. But at the end of the day, he is a Hufflepuff. And so those are his values.
And I mean, that ultimately comes to his downfall.
Yeah.
Is that for both Harry and for Cedric. And I think that that's really important to note, that both of them are, like, so nice and so, like, competitive, but also they're very, I don't know, like, they like to work in community. They're people who have their core group of people. They like to succeed, not at the expense of others.
Mm-hmm. It's like no one left behind.
Yeah.
Kind of a mentality. But yeah, so they end up helping each other. And then you find out that, like, Mad-Eye Moody, kind of behind the scenes, has been the one pulling some strings.
Yeah.
So he's the one who actually told Cedric to try opening the egg underwater. He gives the Gillyweed book to Neville. But then you find out Harry never confides in Neville, so that
Harry's
was
not
a
asking
swing
anyone.
And a miss.
Yeah, seriously. Harry is so funny. He's not independent because he has Ron and Hermione, but outside of that core group of people, he's like, well, I guess I'll figure it out on my own. Like, he never asks anyone else, which, I mean,
that,
he could.
That's a theme throughout the books, yeah. Where it's like, okay, well, this is me, and I have to do it. And his friends are always like, Harry, how many times do we have to tell you? You literally can't just do it on your own. You're not the smartest. He's the bravest.
Yeah.
That's what sets him apart. He's all in, all gas, no brakes. Shoot first, ask questions later. That's Harry's superpower. So he doesn't even really realize. He thinks that he's, like, you know, really trying to not cheat, not trying to get, you know, help from Bagman and these other people that are helping him. But when you look at it, it's like, well, he was tipped off about the dragons from Hagrid, and then he got help from Cedric, and then he gets a ton of help from Ron and Hermione when he's training for the maze. So as much as Harry tried to, like, do it on his own, he didn't. He got a lot of help.
Yeah, and I mean, when he reaches out to Sirius about his vision at the very his scar, yeah, at the very beginning of the book, he, you know, Sirius comes back and he's like, oh my gosh, I don't want you here. Like, what if you get in trouble? Like, what if you get caught? All this stuff. And he immediately, like, retracts into this, like, traumatized little kid who, you know, lost his parents and doesn't want anyone else to get hurt.
Yeah.
Because of him. Even though that's definitely not the way it actually is in reality. But, I mean, we've all had those moments where you really overthink things and you're like, this is all my fault. And you're like, no, this is... That's extenuating so circumstances.
It's his trauma response. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Totally. And so you do get Sirius coming back. And I love that Sirius totally takes on that, like, dad role. That mm-hmm. uncle, that protector, that person who is going to fight for you in all situations at their own cost because yeah. they want to.
I love that. And I love that you find out later, too, because, you know, Sirius comes back and he's living kind of, like, outside of Hogsmeade in that cave or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he's keeping an eye on what's going on in the world. He's stealing copies of the Daily Prophet. Like, he is in it. And so every time Harry's always like, no, like, don't come, don't help. And he's like, okay, first of all, I'm already here. Second of all, I've already done extensive research. And then third of all, you find out he's in cahoots with Dumbledore this whole time. So it's like, Harry's never really experienced what having a parent or guardian is like. And so he is used to people just, like, leaving him to fend for himself. And then you find out later, well, actually, no, he couldn't have kept Sirius away. Sirius already made all these plans with Dumbledore. And mm-hmm. he's, like, very much so orchestrating behind the scenes ways to keep Harry safe.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really nice to see that. It's really nice to see that. And it does set you up for the next books of yeah. just seeing these people that want to fight for and with Harry to fight evil, you know, like.
Yeah. And also kind of going off of that, we've talked about before how Sirius and Hagrid are really the two adult characters more than anyone else who, well, and the Weasleys too, but those two really, like, take on a fatherly uncle family, but, like, a guardian kind of family role with him. And you see that again with Hagrid in this book, because you find out about Hagrid's backstory and how his mother was a giant and she left him and his father. And then you find out that Hagrid's father passed away, like, when he was really young. And so
his first year of yeah, Hogwarts,
you find out, you're like, oh, I get it. Like, yes, Hagrid is a guy with a heart of gold, and but he really took an affinity for Harry. And it makes sense because it's like, he knows what it's like. He knows what it's like to be an orphan. And mm-hmm. he knows more than just, like, oh, you need food, you need shelter, you need these basic needs. He's like, you need love, you need support, you need a photo album of your parents, you mm-hmm. need these, someone to tell you memories about your parents, because he needed it too.
Yeah. And Hagrid is someone who's experienced being an outcast for who he is
mm-hmm.
from the very beginning. Harry's always getting stared at, all this stuff. And so is Hagrid. And so, honestly, now thinking about, like, their moments in Diagon Alley when people are, like, staring at Hagrid and stuff like that, and he just kind of is, like, fine with it, just kind of accepts it, because he's gotten to this point where he is who he is. And that kind of takes away from people staring at Harry.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool to have that modeled for him of, like, you're gonna get people that stare at you. You're gonna get people that are, you know, wanting kind of, like, pieces of you in certain moments. And, like, this is how you handle it.
I've never really thought about that before. That's so true. They do have so many similarities. And also, like, being stared at for Hagrid, he's just used to it. Mm-hmm. So whereas someone else might be around Harry and be like, oh my God, this is so weird to get all this attention, this is all new, Hagrid might not even notice that it's happening.
Yeah.
That's just the way that he's always lived his life.
Yeah.
Aw.
I love that.
I love them. And I mean, there's so many lovable characters in this book. Yeah, mm-hmm. you get so much good, like, Sirius and Harry moments. And you get some really cool flashbacks in this book.
Yeah.
And we love the flashbacks.
Yeah. So the Pensieve ends up playing another vital role in, you know, the whole series. but this is your first introduction of that. And I love the depiction of it, that it's just like this swirling, like if water were to be made into, you know, a different, like, it's just, it's really pretty, and that that would be enticing, that that would be something that draws you to it, because who doesn't love hearing what other people's stories and experiences are? Like,
I've already confessed to being an Aunt Petunia in my soul, so I absolutely would have peeked into that pensieve.
Oh yeah, no boundaries. And then Harry jumping in and getting put into a place of, this is post my parents being killed, and like very much trying to clean up the mess that has been left from Voldemort and his reign of terror and all the Death Eaters that are around.
Yeah.
And so you see Moody being there, having caught so many of these Death Eaters, and you get to see, yeah, that moment of Ludo Bagman. You also see Igor Karkaroff, and you're like, okay, so he was a Death Eater. You see here that Snape was a former Death Eater, and that Voldemort, or that Dumbledore, is like vouching for him.
And that's the first time that's ever confirmed. So Snape has been a total poophead this whole series to Harry, just so rude. And he's always the one that Harry is suspecting, you know, like, somebody's trying to kill me, it's Snape.
He's evil.
Snape is evil. Snape's a bad guy. But we don't have any confirmation until this book that, yeah, he was a Death Eater.
Mm-hmm. Not a great guy to be around.
No.
And then you hear of all these like very prominent names that have been like quote unquote cleared by the ministry. You've got McNair, you've got Avery, you've got, you know, Malfoy, you've got Knott, I think, is another one. And you're like, okay, so these are all people that have been cleared because they've all been like under the Imperius curse. And you're like, okay, so you were just doing Lord Voldemort's bidding because you were forced to? Yeah.
It's such an easy scapegoat. You're like, I didn't do it. Someone told me to do it. Someone made me do it.
Yeah, and there's no way to, like, prove it.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, cool. Way to go. Way to stand up for this. And then you do see Barty Crouch Jr. coming out. And so, like, you have Barty Crouch Sr. that's kind of shown that he has taken a very hard stance on all of these Death Eaters, no mercy. And then his son's there, and that his son was there with Bellatrix Lestrange and her husband, and I believe another Death Eater, and Barty Crouch Jr. They are terrorizing and using the Cruciatus curse against Frank Longbottom and his wife Alice. And that's when you see what Neville's experience was.
Yeah.
Of growing up without parents, just like Harry. But I know that my parents were just tortured for hours and hours and hours until they're literally insane.
Yeah. It's so messed up because, like, their methods were so brutal. And then you also know, like, you basically established that that is a really hardcore group of Death Eaters, because everyone else, you know, you got Karkaroff at that same time singing like a canary, and you've got other people being like, oh yeah, no, I didn't do it, it was the Imperius curse. And these four have like doubled down, and they're like, no, we're still gonna go out and do the Dark Lord's bidding, we're gonna torture people, and we're looking for him. So it's like, who, if they hadn't have been caught for torturing Neville's parents, they would have just gone on to the next group, and they would have just continued because they were so dedicated.
Yeah, Bellatrix has like this whole monologue about, like, you can put me in Azkaban, the Dark Lord will rise and he will come for me and I will be back. Whereas Barty Crouch Jr., he was not super loyal to the Dark Lord. He still gets sentenced to Azkaban, but homeboy is out here being like, dad, please, no, dad, father. And you're like, your privilege can get you pretty far, but not at this point. Like, you did it. You did it, and it was wrong. And you can say that, oh, I wasn't there. And I'm like, so where do you get off now that you've, you know, gotten out of Azkaban? You imprisoned Moody. You have been teaching dark arts, and you get Harry to the Triwizard Tournament, blah, blah, blah. Where do you get off as being like, I am the most faithful servant, like, I have done all this stuff for the Dark Lord? And it's like, you did do really shady stuff and you did go back to the Dark Lord, and I think that you would have, if you weren't convicted and sent to Azkaban, stayed true to the Dark Lord. But, like, you were kind of a pansy. Like, you didn't stay true to what you claim to be.
I do think that he is, like, the most similar to Lord Voldemort himself, though. So when he draws those comparisons of saying, like, we both murdered our father and we both, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think that if this makes sense, if Lord Voldemort was a Death Eater, he would have done the same things. Like, he would have been hardcore. He would have continued, like, fighting for the cause. But he also would have taken that first, like, ticket out of Azkaban immediately.
Yeah.
And then justified it as, like, well, I'm doing it so that I can go find him. Like, I think it takes, like, a certain level of narcissism and delusion to, like, totally cash in on your privilege, mm-hmm. and then still be like, I am the most loyal.
Yeah, I'll give you that. And I, like, you find out after Victor Crumb and Harry have been, like, talking near the edge of the forest, and I love that moment too. Victor Crumb being, like, jealous of Harry and Hermione's relationship. I think that's so cute.
Oh yeah, because of Rita Skeeter.
Yeah.
Who is
a monster.
We'll talk about her a lot more in the movie,
yeah,
episode, because they cast her just perfectly.
But then you have Barty Crouch that comes running to them, and he's, like, insane. And, you know, and you see that Victor is, like, scared by this situation, and Harry kind of jumps into action of, like, let's get Dumbledore, let's get this, you know, let's get him to safety, basically. But then to later hear the story from Barty Crouch Jr. when he's given the truth serum of how he got out of Azkaban, it really wasn't anything that he did. It was his mother. Again, yeah. His mother's love and compassion, wanting to get her son out because she was dying. And so they took Polyjuice Potion and they were, you know, able to switch bodies. And she stayed in Azkaban and died. And Barty Jr. got out and was put under the Imperius curse, but he started fighting it. And
yeah, and he spent the whole time, like, his mother died for him to get out, and he spent the whole time being like, my dad's so mean to me, my dad mm-hmm. uses the Imperius curse on me, and he won't even let me get out and do evil things.
Yeah. And
you're like, okay, cry me a river.
He only loved my mom. And it's like, well, you know what? He probably loved you too to some extent, but you can't go around torturing people for a super long time yeah. and expect your dad to be like, oh, yep, it's okay. Let's forgive this one.
No. So no. When your child is born a homicidal maniac, you don't get to show them the same kind of love that you would show a child with empathy.
Yeah, it's conditional.
Yeah.
It's conditional love, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But Barty is like, Barty Crouch Jr. is just a sociopath, psychopath, all of the paths.
Yeah. We need like a criminal profiler to tell us.
Like, yeah.
Cause he is just all of the things, but his evil plan works and he gets Harry through that last challenge. They get to the port key and, like, by this point, you do love Cedric. You're like, he's yeah. just, like, a stand-up guy. He's Harry's competition, but, like, he's always just been nice and, like, honorable about it.
Well, and Harry, when they get to the center of the maze, Harry is injured, and he's not going to be able to get to the Triwizard Cup. And Cedric is there, and he is able-bodied at this point and can get to the cup. And Harry's like, now it's just race. You're gonna win. Like, it's yours. And yeah. Cedric's like, but you just helped me so then I didn't get killed in this maze. Like, let's share it. And Harry and him are just, like, back and forth.
Yeah, they're
just
both like, I wouldn't be able to get to it first. And they're both right.
Yeah. And, I mean, they're like Canadian drivers of, like, you go first. No, you go first. No, you go. First. You go. No, you go. You. Yeah. And, like, in the end, they're like, okay, let's share this. We can share in this glory. We can share in this triumph for our school and for ourselves. Like, I wouldn't have been able to do this without you, and you wouldn't have been able to do it without me. And I mean, that's a beautiful moment.
It is. And then they touch the port key that they don't know is a port key. They show up in some creepy cemetery. And moments later, Cedric Diggory is straight up murdered. And yeah. That exact moment is when this entire series, like, turns.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, the series has always been dark. There's always been Lord Voldemort. There's always been people after Harry trying to kill him. But there's always been, like, okay, we were able to do this and get out of it. And, you know, like, it kind of takes this turn. And in this moment, it's like, nope, we're going to start killing people off. And it's going to be people that you care about.
Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting. I didn't actually, like, look into any of this, but that chapter is really short. And I would be curious to see if it is the shortest chapter in the whole series. It's like 4 or 5 pages where it's just like they get in the port key, they're in the cemetery, Cedric dies, Harry has blood taken from him, and like, boom, Voldemort's back. It is so quick. Mm-hmm. Because that pace is what you feel. It's yep. It's not something that's long and drawn out at this point. It is just like, someone's dead, I'm stuck, I'm injured, I can't get out of here, that's Voldemort, and Wormtail's here, and I know he's not good, and something is happening. He is coming back, and I can't get out of this. Like, that's a really fast moment, and you feel the, like, panic in it.
It's intense, and it kind of, like, takes your breath away.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh my god, this just got real.
Yeah. And speaking of getting real, let's take a moment to
hear from our sponsors.
Yeah.
For this episode.
Let's do that.
Changed the game just now. I have a rave.
These are the best ideas I've ever heard.
I'm Seth Rogen.
I'm saying that's the commentary that will exist.
A Barbie girl in a Barbie world.
Defiled Mickey Mouse. Vroom, 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 vroom,
vroom, vroom, vroom, vroom. Oh my god!
Listen to new episodes weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
So I think one of the best parts of this book is that we get a double twist at the ending. So I think the first three books kind of establish this formula towards the end where, like, Harry gets himself into hot water, some crazy situation. Harry and Ron and Hermione, like, help him get out of whatever situation he's in. And then it kind of winds down and he gets back to Dumbledore. He debriefs with Dumbledore. And then he heads back home for the summer.
Yeah, it kind of wraps up and, like, ends. Like, in the first one, it's like, okay, so he's no longer in Quirrell. Quirrell is gone, and you go home. And, you know, the Philosopher's Stone is taken care of.
Yeah.
And then you have the Chamber of Secrets when he, you know, defeats the Basilisk, pierces the diary, Horcrux, and Tom Riddle is gone, and the Chamber of Secrets is done.
And, like, Fox flies everyone out of mm-hmm. the Chamber of Secrets. Yeah, and then they go debrief with Dumbledore in
Prisoner of
Azkaban. They're in the Shrieking Shack. They get all of that information. They end up going back. That one, I guess there is a little bit of a double twist.
Yeah.
Because then you get the time turner where they go back and, like, do it all again.
Mm-hmm. And that it was, like, Wormtail all along that was...
Okay, so there's a little bit of a double twist there. But then this one, I feel like the twist with the port key and then, like, Cedric dies and Voldemort gets a body and there's so much that happens there that it really does, like, when he comes back, you feel like, wow, there's still, I think there's, like, 5 chapters left after that or something, and you're kind of mm-hmm. like, wait, how is there still so much more? Like, wasn't that the climax? And then you get the whole twist with Barty Crouch Jr. and
Winky and
Winky, and you get, like, so much exposition about what happened because of the truth serum, the Veritas serum, mm-hmm. whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And
Fudge and Dumbledore are on the outs now because Dumbledore is like, I know that Voldemort is back, mm-hmm. and the reason I knew that wasn't Moody is because Moody would never take you away from this safe situation mm-hmm. with me had I asked. So you know it's not Moody, or Dumbledore knows it's not Moody. We yeah. don't know that. And then you have the Dementors that come in and give Barty Crouch Jr. the kiss. Mm-hmm. And so now he is no longer a credible source. Nobody's going to believe Harry because they don't want to believe the worst.
No. Yeah, I feel like Fudge is so concerned with, I mean, he's a politician first and foremost, right? So he wants to keep the people happy. He wants to keep the people supportive of him and the ministry and keep them easy to govern.
Mm-hmm.
And Dumbledore is coming at it from a very different point of view, because we know that he was amongst the wizards who really like fought against Voldemort
mm-hmm.
the first time. And so Dumbledore's coming at it from that perspective of like, I know exactly how hard this was last time, and we got to get started on this right away.
Yeah, we didn't recognize the signs immediately the first time around because we didn't know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have seen the signs, and I have been kind of looking into it. And then we have this firsthand account of someone that I trust completely. But, I mean, you have the work of Rita Skeeter coming in beforehand, setting up that Harry is not a credible source,
yes.
that he is, you know, unwell from this curse, which, to be fair, if you didn't know Harry and you're just a wizard out there in the world, you wouldn't necessarily know if this curse has had these really terrible effects on him long term.
Yeah. No, they definitely set it up really well to not believe Harry, but yeah, Dumbledore just immediately, and there is proof too, because Dumbledore was in the room with the truth serum, so like he knows for a fact that Barty Crouch Jr., like he knows exactly what he did. He saw the real Alistair Moody mm-hmm. hidden in a trunk with half of his hair missing because of a year's worth of Polyjuice potion. So like there is concrete evidence that's also presented. There's the dead body of Cedric Diggory, and he knows like Harry didn't kill him.
No.
And there's nothing, you can tell, like he's not mauled by one of these magical creatures mm-hmm. that would have been in the maze. So they know like this was an unforgivable curse.
Yeah.
And then seeing who was like, it's students that were in the maze. Yeah, they're going to be competitive and they're going to want to win, but nobody is going to Avada Kedavra one of their competitors.
Well, Harry is not an advanced enough wizard in order to pull that off.
No.
He doesn't have enough power in him.
No, it would have had to have been Crumb or Fleur, but Fleur had already like sent up the red sparks. She was done. And then
Crumb was stunned by Harry.
Yeah, Crumb was stunned by Harry, and Crumb had been placed under the
Imperious curse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he started attacking everybody. So to Dumbledore, he's like, okay, A plus B equals C. This all makes sense. And then you get Fudge coming in, and he's like, yeah, but I don't like that you're saying it equals C, because C is bad for me and bad for business. So I'm going to kind of be very selective about how I interpret this evidence.
It's crazy, though. It's true, though. When you don't want to believe something,
mm-hmm.
that you can have as much evidence, concrete or not, placed in front of you, and you're still not going to come to the correct conclusion.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to.
You just don't want to believe it.
And I mean, some of the things that happened are unbelievable. With the twin cores, you have, well, number one, I love this. Voldemort is like, I'm going to kill Harry, but I want to not only kill you, I want you to be fighting back at me. Yeah. I want to see me like really overpower you.
I want my most loyal followers, the ones that come back when he sends out the dark mark. I want to do it in front of my followers, and I want to mock you.
Yeah.
You know, like, because Harry really does think he's going to die.
Yeah.
For a lot of this. And so Harry's own form of rebellion is basically like, well, I'm not going to give you what you want. So you're wanting to humiliate me, or you're wanting me to beg.
I'm not going to die on my knees.
I'm going to
die fighting like my parents. And that's the way I'm going to go.
Yeah. I'm going to resist the Imperious curse with every fiber of my being. And he's mm-hmm. very stubborn. So he can quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so that's his kind of he's resigned himself to, like, yeah, if this guy wants to kill me, he's going to kill me. There's nothing I can do, but I can at least piss him off in the meantime.
Yeah, I'm not going to go down just...
I'm not going to give you what you want. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I love that. And then that Voldemort is, you know, trying to curse him or kill him. I can't remember which spell he's... or what he's doing. But then Harry at the same time is like, Expelliarmus. And that they connect at that exact moment. And with the twin cores, with them being, you know, brothers, essentially, they don't want to fight against each other. They don't like this because that's not what they were created to do. They're, you know, they don't want to have the other one, you know, kill the other one. That's not the move. So the fact that it's connected and that you hear the Phoenix song as it's happening. And then, like, the golden, like, kind of cage sets in where it, like, divides Voldemort and Harry from the Death Eaters.
Yeah, it talks about how, the two curses, or it's, like, Expelliarmus, and I think it was Avada Kedavra, basically, like, the two spells meet in the middle, and then it creates this, like...
connection.
Yeah, almost like a, like, lightning bolt that connects the two wands together, and then it creates this like special cage because it's like more and more strands of this like golden kind of lightning material start coming out. And then we start seeing
that the wands are like shaking, and there's like a specific kind of like, I don't know, bead within the beam that like can go one way or the other more. As Harry's like getting it coming towards him, he's like, I don't know what this means, but I don't want this to happen to me.
Yep. So he kind of uses his mind power to like send it back to Voldemort. Because I just feel like Harry is more humble than Voldemort. So Voldemort's not necessarily like looking at the bigger picture. And Harry's just kind of like, I really think I'm gonna die and I don't really have much of a chance, but I will, you know, be so aware of what's going around me and I'll take whatever chance I can get. I'm not above anything, or like there's no pride to save here. I'm not trying to look powerful.
I think that he knows that he's not powerful, so he's like, holy moly, I need both hands on this wand and I need to just only concentrate on this and give everything that I have to this moment. Whereas Voldemort is like, I've killed a bunch of people, like I'm like a really strong wizard, so he's like not necessarily putting that much effort into it, but Harry really is.
And so he's able to send like like that little bead of energy or whatever it is, like all the way over to Voldemort's wand. And then we start seeing like the last spells basically that Voldemort had performed with that wand. So we see like,
but in reverse, like, so people that he's killed are like kind of coming back to life in like a shadow form of themselves.
Yeah, I think Dumbledore describes it as an echo.
Yeah,
so it's like an echo of the spell. So it's we see like he had just restored Wormtail's hand, and so like that kind of appears. And then we see he had killed
Cedric was the next one that comes out, and then you see Bertha Jorkins and then Frank,
the game groundskeeper. Why do I keep calling him a gamekeeper? The groundskeeper. Yeah. And then
there's like a big gap where I thought that there would be like more people. I'm like, okay, who else is going to come out? Because again, it's been so long since I've read it. And then it's Lily.
Yeah.
And then it's James. And they're able to speak, which is like so interesting that they're like able to come out and like have this moment of intimacy with Harry. You have Cedric that's like, hey, please bring my body back to my parents.
Yeah.
And then Lily comes over and like whispers in his ear, like, hold on tight, your father's coming.
Yeah.
What?
And they're all in Harry's corner, which is really cool. Cedric is like, hold on to that wand. Like they can kind of figure out what's going on a little bit. So he's like, hold on tight. And then Frank comes out and he's a muggle, but Frank comes out and he's like, oh, so that guy is a wizard that killed me. And I forget exactly what he says, but he basically is like, give him hell, kid.
Yeah.
Like he's like in Harry's corner too. And so, yeah. And then his mom and his dad come out and they like give him some advice to help him. And I think
even more people start showing up. And yeah. and at that moment, Voldemort, they say that he looks scared. That, you know, these are all people, these shadow people that you have killed, interacted with. And, you know, like, and I don't understand the magic that's going on. And I think, yet again, it's him underestimating this, like, old magic or, like, these deeper cuts of magic that are good.
Yeah.
And he just, he doesn't understand it.
Laws of nature and things where it's, like, when you kill people, like, you're committing such a deeply evil act that there's always going to be consequences for that.
Mm-hmm.
And he has just lived so much of his life kind of avoiding those consequences and feeling like he is above them. So then he gets into this moment and it's like, well, if Harry and Voldemort were dueling and everyone that came out of Voldemort's wand, like, hated Harry, then they wouldn't have helped him.
Yeah.
But the magic is, like, Harry was a good person. Harry was kind to people. So yeah, everyone that came out of the wand is like, yeah, I want to help Harry.
Yeah.
And I don't want to help Voldemort because he's evil. So I think Voldemort just consistently, in literally every single book, continues to underestimate the value of teamwork and family and, like, helping. It's like, yeah, you're not just coming after Harry because Harry has a community of people around him that are rooting for him.
Yeah. And they're not doing it out of fear. They're willing to sacrifice, not because they're, like, sniveling little, like, oh,
yeah,
I'll do whatever you want, master. It's like, no, I'm going to go down with a fight for this kid. Like, I'm not going to let you do this easily.
So true. And that's so powerful. Yeah. Because, yeah, if you're serving someone out of fear, then as soon as, you know, they're gone or that fear is removed, like, you don't have that same level of motivation to help them. But when it's, yeah, when it's a selfless thing, when you're like, this person is a nice person, I don't like bad things to happen.
Yeah.
To my friends, to my son, to people that I care about. Yeah. You're going to help. So that whole scene is really cool. And they basically tell Harry, like, okay, like, when you let go of the wand, like, you're going to have a couple seconds and, you know,
we can linger on for just a moment to protect you, but it's not going to be very long. And so Harry is ready to, like, get to Cedric's body and somehow get out of there. And luckily, yet again, because not that Barty Crouch Jr. was wanting to, you know, set him up for success, but Harry couldn't summon anything until the first challenge where he had to summon his Firebolt or Nimbus 2000. Whichever one.
Firebolt.
He has to summon it from really far away. Before that, he couldn't do it at all. So he's practiced a ton. And so he's at Cedric's body. And then he can summon the Triwizard turn the cup. And you know.
He's able to go back.
So yet again, it's people underestimating Harry. And the few things that he does know, he does it well. And he's going to, you know, continue to fight. No matter what.
Yeah. And it's that Gryffindor energy in him where it's like his parents don't tell him, like, oh, don't worry about this. You can do it, honey. It's like, hey, you got a couple seconds. We're going to do all we can.
You got to go.
Go for it. And it's like, even in that moment, like, there's no guarantee that Harry is going to make it back to the Portkey, that he's going to survive. So he's literally running for his life.
Yeah.
To get back over there.
And I mean, this is a kid who is injured and just saw someone die and saw his parents for the first time ever. You know, like, these are some big things that are happening, and yet, like, that is not what's crossing his mind. There's no physical pain at this point. It's just pure adrenaline.
And in another way that Voldemort also just, like, underestimated the value of other people, because he thinks he's just, like, so much better than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So when Harry goes back and he's talking to Dumbledore later about what happened with the Twin Core, Dumbledore is like, oh, okay, he already knows what's going on. Because he's like, yeah, it's a Twin Core. You know, you have a phoenix feather from Fox in your wand. So does Voldemort. And you find out that, like, Dumbledore has been sitting on that information since Harry's first year at school, because Ollivander
New.
Ollivander knows everything about those wands. And so he, you know, he's like, oh, very curious or whatever when Harry gets his wand. And the first thing he does once Harry leaves is write to tell Dumbledore, because Ollivander understands there are deeper levels of magic. So it's like there's going to be some type of connection between these two wands. And it's very strange that like mortal enemies ended up with these two different wands. But like, that's important information and Dumbledore needs to know it.
Yeah, well, and
Voldemort had no clue because he's not out here thinking about like, ooh, I wonder what's in other people's wands and what power do they have. He's like, no, these little peons, who cares about them? I'm the greatest wizard in the world and I can use this wand for whatever.
And I could use any wand and do whatever I want because I'm that good. And it's not necessarily the tool, it's who's wielding it. And you're like, oh, but
for sure.
There's a little more going on.
Pride comes before the fall.
Yeah.
And that's just one more way that that happens for Voldemort.
Yeah. And I also love that he gets a monologuing. I mean, like, in every single, like the Incredibles. Where it's like, oh, you got me monologuing. And, like, there's Voldemort. And he's like, oh, I'm getting sentimental, you know. And he's just talking and talking and talking because he's just savoring the fact that he is back better than ever and gonna take you down.
And he gives Harry all this information because, again, he thinks, well, this kid's not getting away from me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell him about my muggle father and how much I despised him. I'll tell him these things. And it's like, yeah, he got me monologuing. I totally had the same thought.
Yeah.
When I was reading it. That part is just, it's so good. And it just shows all these ways that, like, yeah, Harry is magically protected. And if you just take that out, like, those themes are so universal in the real world too. Like,
what comes around goes around.
And like, having family that is looking out for you, having friends that are looking out for you, a community, being humble enough to respect other people, to listen to other people, like, these are things that always,
they hold value,
help you in the long run. Not always instantaneously, not always in the ways that you would imagine, but like, there is power in kindness and community.
Yeah.
And if you remove yourself from that, even if you are really powerful,
then
you're missing something.
You're the only person who has your back.
Yeah.
And I mean, the only reason Voldemort was even able to survive is because Wormtail, you know, ended up finding him.
Yep.
You know, so he can talk about all this power and stuff, but at the end of the day, he was incredibly weak and he needed somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And he considers that a debt that Wormtail is paying to him. Whereas, like, Harry doesn't consider people who sacrifice stuff for him as a debt. He personally feels more indebted to them.
Yes. Like, he appreciates the sacrifice that people have made for him.
Yeah. And I think that's beautiful. And again, it's just the ways that Harry and Voldemort are so similar, and where they differ, it really makes a difference.
Yeah. And that brings us to the end of the book. So when Dumbledore is at the, like, end of the year feast and he gets up to give a speech, he announces to everybody, like, hey, Voldemort is back. And he knows that, like, the ministry is going to go on to deny that or to try and cover it up, and they're not taking it seriously. And what he says to all of the students is basically, like, Voldemort's back, and now more than ever, the most important thing that we can do is foster community. Like, be there for each other, be kind, stay strong, don't get divided, because if we're divided, like, that's when we're weak. We need to stay together, stay unified, stay strong.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really cool coming out of the Triwizard Tournament because these are students who have never been exposed to other wizards from other areas ever before. And so, like, you do see how that impacts the future. I mean, you have Fleur who goes on to marry Bill and, you know, join the Order of the Phoenix and, like, is, like, fighting for what's good and right. And, you know, you have Hagrid and Madame Maxime that are going out to foster relations with the giants, which, I mean, you end up hearing about in the next book. And so you have this unique moment where you have so many people who are of the same age and, you know, demographic, but from vastly different geographic locations. And so it's like, if you can, you know, stay strong together, you are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's true.
Yeah, it is. And that's where we end the book. And it's an interesting ending because it's like, in the previous three books, you know, Harry survives something crazy and then he goes home for the summer and is just like excited to come back to Hogwarts. And this is the turning point, you know, the middle book in the series where it's like Harry goes home to Hogwarts, but we know like Voldemort is back.
Yeah.
So over the summer, like he's going to be making moves, but we also know Dumbledore's making moves too. And so it's this weird mix of like Harry's going to go home and hang out with the Dursleys, but like he knows that his life and the world are not going to be the same. And we don't know where it's headed.
Yeah. And Dumbledore leads it with a call to action for multiple staff members and to the students and like for everyone to take action on this.
Yeah.
And I guess every other book when Harry's gotten into like this trouble and then he shows courage and, you know, all this stuff, and it ends up with like you get house points, you know, and then Gryffindor wins the house cup.
Yeah.
And this one, he walks in and it's just black, like all the drapes are black and it's like nobody wins.
Yeah, that's
what,
true.
What happened is an incredible loss to all of us. So in this moment, like, we're not celebrating anything. We're not winning these arbitrary points. We lost Cedric.
Yeah.
And he is dead and he is never coming back. And there are things happening that we need to do to work against so that this doesn't continue, because this is what happened. And we were talking earlier and Ziana was like, it's the time when Dumbledore really talks to them, not like students or kids, but like actual members of the community in the wizarding world.
Yeah, he takes them very seriously. And he says, you know, a lot of people don't want me to share this information with you. And maybe even your parents don't want me to tell you, you know, that Voldemort is back. But Dumbledore knows, like, if we just ignore this and pretend like everything's okay, then all of these kids that I'm looking at right now are going to be dead.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a bunch of kids that are not going to make it. And so he's like, yeah, I don't want to give you this information. It kind of sucks. It's a real downer. But I need each and every one of you to do your part because I'm counting on you.
And I can't do it alone.
I can't do this alone. I know that there are things that, you know, kids at Hogwarts or kids at Durmstrang, kids from Beauxbatons, that they can do that Dumbledore can't because he's only one man.
Yeah.
You know, so he's counting on everyone. And with the symbolism of the black banners being hung instead of the different Hogwarts houses and instead of the different schools, he is addressing like a room full of three different schools with all the different Hogwarts houses, but he's talking to them as one. Like, we are the wizarding community.
Mm-hmm.
We are humans. We are all in this together.
And you're not too young to do things about it.
No.
You know, so it's not just like, oh, tell your parents when you get home, Voldemort's back, so then they can do stuff, you know. Hey, like, no, it's, you are an age where you deserve to know what's going on.
Yeah.
And you have the power to affect change.
Yeah. That's powerful. And this book is so good.
It's really good. There's so many little like Easter eggs and so many really like powerful underlying themes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love it. I mean, again, every single book just kind of gets bigger and darker and better than the last one because you have so much more to digest within it.
Yeah. This is the real turning point though.
Yeah.
It's like the first four books, Voldemort's a bad guy. We think he might be out there. And then it's like, well, we confirm that he's out there, but he's formless. And now it's like, okay, no, he's back.
He has supporters.
His power. He has supporters.
He knows where you are and he's going to keep coming after you.
He's upset. So I can't wait to read The Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah. I mean, The Order of the Phoenix is my favorite book, but
this sets it up just so
I know
brilliantly.
Yes.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you for following along with the Basic Cinephile podcast. We hope you're loving it as much as we are, because I am having so much fun.
I'm having so much fun. I mean, if you started reading or watching along while, you know, joining in on the podcast, please feel free to like reach out to us on Instagram at the Basic Cinephile, on Twitter at the Basic Cinef 1. That's the number 1. So it's Cinephile without the ILE and the number 1. You can hit us up on
Facebook
at
the Basic Cinephile, and you can find us at thebasiccinephile.com. We do like little show notes and different little like blog posts about Harry Potter. But yeah, we'd love to hear from you and see what you are loving about the Harry Potter read along, watch along,
what you've learned.
Yes, we'd love to hear all of that. And please, if you could leave us a rating, you can now rate podcasts on Spotify.
Woo.
That's a new feature. So if you're loving what you hear, please give us a rating. If you hate it, you don't have to give us a rating.
Maybe
if you don't
just
like
DM
it.
Us,
but if you love it, you definitely, yes, you definitely need to give us a rating, or leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We are doing new episodes every Thursday, so be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
We'll be back next week.
Yeah. So jazzed about this.
All right. Bye.
Bye.